Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
The House of Commons approves a combat mission against ISIS, meaning our fighter jets will soon head to Kuwait, where they'll be based before launching airstrikes on the terrorist group. McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru is on the ground in northern Iraq and updates us on the military and humanitarian needs.
From foreign terrorism to homegrown extremism, the RCMP confirms it has 63 active investigations on 90 people in Canada suspected of taking part in terrorist activities with groups abroad. The Public Safety Minister, Stephen Blaney, joins us to discuss the threat at home.
The Harper government is planning to change copyright laws to use news content in political ads without getting the permission of news organizations. The conservative argument is that these companies may be censoring what Canadians see. The McLean's panel weighs in.
We also speak with Edmonton Mayor Don Iveson about the infrastructure needs of Canadian municipalities. Economics professor Miles Korak discusses income inequality in education. And we bring you Question Period in Review.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. An advanced team for Canada's military is on the ground in the Middle East preparing to take part in the combat mission against ISIS. On Tuesday, MPs stood in the House of Commons to cast their vote on a government motion to approve the mission.
Yes, pour 157, nays contre 134.
The motion easily passed despite objections from the Liberals and NDP.
The opposition had wanted the government to take on a non-combat mission and focus more on humanitarian aid. But after the vote, Employment Minister Jason Kenney said airstrikes are the right choice.
We're talking about sending six fighters to help defend innocent civilians from a maniacal genocidal death cult.
Liberal defense critic John McKay tells me he's disappointed the government is taking this route and is worried about what it may mean for our troops.
We're being invited down a rat hole into a cauldron of religious eschatology and ideology where normal rules of engagement don't apply. I take the view that no one in the Conservative cabinet has a clue about what they've just invited Parliament to do.
By the end of the week, the government had announced that the base for this air combat mission will be in Kuwait. Six CF-18 fighter jets, along with a refueling plane and two surveillance aircraft, will take off in the next 3 weeks, and they'll later take part in laser-guided airstrikes against ISIS militants. The mission also includes up to 600 military personnel, although there will be no ground combat.
McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru is on assignment in northern Iraq, not far from the war zone where Iraqi forces are doing battle with ISIS militants. Petru has been speaking with displaced Iraqis and Syrian refugees, and I was able to get him on the phone to discuss the military and humanitarian needs on the ground. So, Mike, I guess, first of all, could you give us a sense of the mood in Iraq right now, what you've seen, a sense of things on the ground, I guess?
Well, I think I've experienced two different perspectives. I spent most of yesterday with the Kurdish Peshmerga. These are the folks that are on the front lines against Islamic State and are also benefiting from the airstrikes that the United States and now many of its allies, including Canada, have been launching against Islamic State. So they were reeling in June when Islamic State rampaged through much of Iraq and took the large city of Mosul. They still say that a lot of what they need they haven't received yet. They say they need more heavy weapons, but they say they are very grateful for the air support they've gotten so far. They've spoken about American and French advisors specifically being on the front lines with them, using GPS to map out airstrikes on ISIS positions, which in many cases are visible only a few hundred meters away, which I think gives some indication of what some of these Western advisors are doing. And I would say blurs the line between combat and non-combat. So they're optimistic. They're grateful for the support that they've received. They say they need some more, but they have succeeded in stopping the Islamic State's advance for now. Today, I spent most of my time with refugees and internally displaced people. I have spent a good chunk of the day with Syrian refugees in Iraqi Kurdistan. There are millions, of course, as we know, Syrians that have been displaced because of the civil war in Syria. It's interesting to remember, however, that many of them have fled, perhaps most of them, or certainly most of them, fled well before Islamic State's current onslaught. The Syrian refugees that spoke to today, they left prior to Islamic State's offensive, and this is even though Islamic State is currently assaulting some major cities, including most notably Kobani in Syrian Kurdistan. They left Assad. They fled Assad and the violent and brutal attempt by Assad to crush the revolution against them. They have a very different perspective, of course. They're homesick. They are living in, I mean, certainly the camps are clean and they appear to be well run, but they're also bleak and difficult places to live. After that, I went to a camp for displaced Iraqis. Because they are Iraqis, they're in their own country. We were not supposed to call them refugees. However, speaking to one of the administrators of the camp, he said that this camp was a temporary measure. These people are in their own homes, and they're not meant to stay here long-term. When I asked him when the camp would close, he said, nobody knows. This is an even rougher place, and these Iraqis, many of those that I spoke to had come from the Sinjar area, and they were living in very rough conditions, and they had faced the onslaught of Islamic State and really experienced terrible treatment. Many of them had lost relatives in horrific fashion. Some of them are still in touch with friends or in-laws that had stayed behind, and they describe also a quite bleak existence under Islamic State. So those people, of course, are much less optimistic and are understandably a lot more saddened and ground down by the situation, what they've been through in the last few months.
Is it possible to gauge at all, or is there any sense of how decisive or how important the Western campaign will be, both in terms of airstrikes and in terms of military support and humanitarian aid? Is there a feeling that that is going to maybe tip the balance or start to kind of turn the tide here?
It's hard to know. I mean, the Kurdish Peshmerga, again, they reiterate that they're grateful for the response that has so far been coming, but they all say they need more. They say especially to take territory, they need heavy weapons, tanks, large guns, that sort of thing. They point out that these weaponry and hardware was captured by Islamic State, taken from the Iraqi army, but the Kurds, the Kurdish Peshmerga, say that they don't have it. Some of them, you have an interesting perspective, I guess, from different Syrians and Iraqis, those that are opposed to Islamic State. I've heard from several Iraqis very insistent that they want not just air power, they want American soldiers back in Iraq. They want boots on the ground. They talk about they would welcome and they would work with soldiers from all the Western countries, and practically pleading that these soldiers arrive. Others will say, when it's pointed out to them, that there's a certain wariness in many Western countries about putting any sort of boots on the ground and troops in harm's way, especially given the recent history of Western intervention in Iraq. Some of them will say, "Look, we don't need your boots on the ground. This is our fight. We need air. We need training. We need more weapons. We need more air support. We need a safe haven from which to advance." So, I mean, a desire for help, I think, is pretty uniformly strong across all of the spectrum of people who have suffered from Islamic State and who want to see it defeated. And it ranges from requests for all-out boots-on-the-ground intervention to something much more reduced in terms of just air, well, more than what's coming now, I suppose it's worth pointing out, but in terms of airstrikes and weapons. No one, I should say, and I should be clear about this, is saying all we need is humanitarian assistance. We don't need any military help. I've spoken pretty much continuously with Iraqis in the few days that I've been here, Iraqis and also Syrian refugees, and no one is saying we don't need military support from the outside world.
Can you give us a sense of sort of day-to-day life? You know, how are things just sort of functioning? Does it feel very precarious? Does it feel like a war zone, I guess?
It depends where you are. I mean, for example, the major cities in Iraqi Kurdistan are thriving. And I was speaking to one individual who was bragging and justifiably quite proud of the progress that Iraqi Kurdistan has made in the last 10 years. You know, he compares it proudly with any country from, you know, from Iraq to the Persian Gulf and beyond. Parts of Iraqi Kurdistan are thriving, booming, and quite liberal, relaxed places. That atmosphere obviously changes on the closer to the front lines, although it's also worth pointing out that at least in areas that I've been to, those lines are fairly well defined and guarded.
Is there any sense, do you think that this is a long fight? I mean, I think that's sort of the general sense in the West that, you know, this isn't going to be resolved in 6 months. But are people, you know, is there an understanding on the ground that this is now going to be a long drawn out battle and a long issue that has to be taken care of sort of over years or at least many months?
No one knows, of course, but I think people are realistic about the scale of the task ahead. Islamic State has a monopoly on the use of force in a good chunk of territory. There is a clear reluctance on the part of the most powerful allies that Iraqi Kurdistan has to put boots on the ground. I think air power is very useful, but it is not. It may not be enough. And again, the Kurds talk about the need for more heavy artillery and tanks, that sort of thing. The Iraqi army, which would have to pick up a lot of the slack outside of Kurdistan, collapsed before Islamic State earlier this year. That doesn't bode well. And of course, we have this rather, well, I don't want to say bizarre, and yet in some ways it is, but this insistence that our response to Islamic State is going to be different in Iraq and in Syria, as if Islamic State folks believe that there's any difference between the two countries at all, which they don't. So pushing Islamic State out of Iraq and leaving them a safe haven in Syria is not going to solve the problem or even come close to solving the problem. So, for example, the reluctance of our Prime Minister Stephen Harper to get involved in Syria, for example, I think ignores the problem of that safe haven. Or if not ignores it, at least doesn't confront it. So again, that's an enormous problem. I think in Iraq and especially in Kurdistan, there is some reason for hope and much more hope in the Kurdish areas of Iraq, where there is a functional state, there's a very professional security service in the form of the Kurdish Peshmerga. But pushing Islamic State out of the Kurdish areas, or pushing them farther back from the Kurdish areas where they are now, even pushing them out of Iraq, is not going to solve Islamic State's problem as long as Islamic State is able to flourish in Syria. And I don't think anyone has really presented a credible plan for dealing decisively with Islamic State in Syria.
That's McLean's foreign correspondent Michael Petru, who is in northern Iraq. For all of Petru's reports on the coalition battle against the ISIS terrorist group, go to mcleans.ca.
Meanwhile, McLean's Washington correspondent Louisa Savage sat down for a one-on-one interview about the ISIS mission with U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson.
So now that Canada has joined the military operation against ISIS, are we at greater risk of retaliatory attacks domestically from the terrorists abroad?
Well, anytime you take the fight to a terrorist organization, we have to be vigilant about the potential for retaliatory attacks. That's not an excuse. That's not a reason to do nothing. This is an organization that has to be stopped. I do think that the Canadian people, as well as the American people in this country, should be vigilant about potential threats to the homeland from terrorist organizations. And I say that not just about ISIL. Part of my job is to make people aware of potential threats to the homeland without unnecessarily alarming people. And so what I have said in this country is, for the time being, we continue to need homeland security in our daily lives, at airports, large public gatherings, other places of transport, because the terrorist threat to our countries still exists, and we have to understand it. We have to understand how it evolves, and we have to be prepared to do what's necessary.
For more of this interview, pick up next week's issue of Maclean's Magazine or keep clicking on Maclean's.ca.
Still to come on the show, we speak about homegrown terrorism with the public safety minister, and later the Maclean's panel weighs in on the government's potential copyright changes to use news content in political ads.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, the Maclean's panel weighs in on the government's potential plan to change copyright laws to use news content in political ads, and the Mayor of Edmonton, Don Iveson, speaks about the infrastructure challenges facing many Canadian cities. But first,
a day after the Harper government passed the motion for a combat mission in Iraq, the Public Safety Committee discussed the threat of terrorism within our borders. The focus was mainly on suspected terrorists who have returned to our country after joining extremist groups abroad. Appearing before the committee were the heads of the RCMP and CSIS, Canada's spy agency, who were joined by Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney.
We know of about 80 who have returned to Canada. Let me be clear, these individuals posing a threat to our security at home have violated Canadian law. These dangerous individuals, some skills and desire to commit terrorist activity, pose a serious threat to law-abiding Canadians. I can confirm for Canadians that as we speak, the RCMP is investigating these individuals and will seek to put them behind bars where they belong.
The RCMP has confirmed it has 63 active investigations on 90 people in Canada who have either traveled abroad for terrorism or who are planning to. Not long after the committee wrapped up, NBC reported the Canadian intelligence officials were aware of a plan to attack embassies and malls in our country using knives and guns. The Toronto Star later reported that this plan had already been dismissed as not a legitimate threat. At committee, the head of CSIS, Michel Coulombe, had said he knew nothing of an impending attack.
To speak more about homegrown extremism and what the government plans to do about it, I sat down with Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney.
Let's start off then with the committee meeting and what some of the details that came out in that meeting. You said specifically that these people have broken the law. Mm-hmm. If they have broken the law, then why, if you're monitoring them, why are they still out there? Why not take them into custody?
Because we are a state of law. And we need to build evidence and lay charges in front of tribunals so they can be charged and sentenced. This has happened already in the past, but the difference in the case of terrorism is that we are relying on intelligence. And that's why it is important that as parliamentarian and as a public safety minister that I make sure that the authority and the legal authority are confirmed and well-framed so that both law enforcement agency and national security force can protect us. That brings me to the fact that as a government, we are removing passport and removing dual citizenship. I've said many times, we don't want anyone, any terrorist to use the Canadian passport to travel abroad and use it at evil means.
Let's talk about the stripping of passports before I go back to what was discussed in the committee, because all we've heard from the government so far is multiple passports seized. How many passports have been seized as a result of the new law so far?
When related issues are related to operational matters, I refer to the law enforcement agency and Canadian immigration citizenship. But the fact that
we haven't been getting answers out of them, and you're updated on these things. You know, you should know at least how many passports have been seized so far.
Well, Cormac, what is important? Numbers are always evolving because the threat is evolving. Accusations are laid. What is important for me to ensure is that our authority and law enforcement has the authority, legal authority, to proceed and protect us. And these issues were raised. We know of people whose passport have been removed. Some we've also seen cases where there's falsification of passport, false passport. What is important for me is to make sure that law enforcement agency have the authority and the legal latitude so they can proceed within the scope of the law. And that's why, as I've just said, it is important for me to make sure that our intelligence is able to know what Canadians are doing when they are abroad. And this is why I intend to bring forward some legislation that will clarify the authority of our law, national security agency.
Just before we jump onto the legislation, one last investigative issue. NBC came out with a report shortly after your committee appearance, I think it was 2 hours after, talking about knife and gun attacks that Canadian security officials had informed them about. But the Toronto Star this morning is saying that security officials actually didn't see it as a legitimate threat at all. A lot of Canadians are a little bit concerned about this when they hear about knife attacks in malls. Was it a dismissed threat?
While I don't comment on operational matter, there are two things that can clearly be said. One that was expressed by a CSIS director on Wednesday, the threat is real, but not imminent. And the other things we can say is that as public safety minister, it is my duty to ensure that our national security agency have all the tools that they need to provide the level of security we are expecting to have in this country.
On the legislation, when are Canadians going to see this new legislation that you and the Prime Minister have been talking about for weeks?
Well, actually, we're Friday today. Prime Minister indicated his intention to move forward with that. This week, we settled the issue of the combat mission in mainly Iraq while we are moving along with 60 other countries. I intend to move in the coming weeks. Next week, we're not sitting, but I intend to move very quickly on that one.
So when the House is back, you intend to move right away?
I intend to move as quickly as I can on this national security issue.
What are the tools that the RCMP and CSIS don't have already? Are you going to be hoping to expand online monitoring? What kind of monitoring are you talking about that they don't already have the right to do?
We want to confirm the authority of the National Security Agency so that they can track Canadians traveling abroad willing to commit terrorist attack and share information and also protect those who are providing this information.
A lot of communications nowadays are mainly online. Is that going to be one of the targets for you with this new legislation?
What is important at this point in time is really to clarify and confirm the authority so our law enforcement agency can fully operate under the scope of the law that is the core of our democracy.
But that doesn't really answer the question. I mean, like, you don't have to give the specifics about what it's going to be.
I will give specific next week about it.
Exit controls, something promised in the Canadian-U.S. security perimeter deal. Why haven't they been implemented yet? They're supposed to be June 30th, and we still don't have them in place. Okay. Why not?
Well, first, it is important to talk about what I would say information sharing. As I say, exit control will leave it to totalitarian state. We live in a free land. And we intend it to stay that way. What it's all about is an agreement with President Obama and Prime Minister Harper when they signed the Beyond the Border Agreement. The goal of this agreement is clear, is to make the flow of goods easily cross the border. The second one, which is as critical, is safety and security. And that's why we've agreed that we would share information on the people traveling abroad. I've met with Secretary Johnson 1 week and a half ago, and he mentioned how important it was to move forward. We both are working. We are willing to now expand the information sharing, not only to foreign national, because now if a foreigner, someone who doesn't have a Canadian passport, is here in Canada and entering into United States, we are sharing this information. Basically, it's the information we find on a passport, The picture of a passport plus where is he crossing that border and at what time is he doing it. So that's information sharing. That's what we're talking about. We are willing to move forward. We are working with our counterpart, and we are committed to deliver and on the commitment of the Beyond the Border. So that's my responsibility, pardon, to move along with that issue.
I just want to know when you plan to implement that finally. I mean, the exit tracking. Maybe controls wasn't the right word, but exit tracking.
This will come more. We're talking more in terms of month. Our drafters are working currently. We are making sure that our legislation is in line with our counterpart, but it's work on the way.
That was Public Safety Minister Stephen Blaney discussing the threat of terrorism in Canada.
The Harper government is seemingly planning to change Canada's copyright laws. It wants to use news content and political advertising without gaining any permission from the news organization that produces the content. The details were released in leaked cabinet documents from Heritage Minister Shelley Glover. She was asked about it during question period and targeted news outlets in her response.
Major television networks should not have the ability to censor what can and cannot be broadcast to Canadians. We believe that this has always been protected under the fair dealing provisions of the law, and if greater certainty is necessary, we will provide it.
To take an in-depth look at this issue, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes hosts this week's Maclean's Panel.
It's time for the Maclean's Panel, and I'm here with my colleagues Paul Wells, our political editor, and Aaron Wary, an associate editor at Maclean's. Now, Aaron, just we'll get into the sort of the judgment calls here, but what's your thought so far on what you heard about the actual legality here? Is A, do they have to change the law to keep using this kind of footage, and B, do you think they'll be able to, or is it going to end up being a legal schmozzle?
Well, I don't know. It's going to be interesting. I think there seems to be an argument that they, A, maybe don't need to change the laws, that they could maybe go ahead and use this footage and win a case
under this principle of fair usage, right?
Yeah. There's another argument that if they really are concerned about fair dealing and fair usage, that they should just expand that. And I think there are going to be interesting legal issues and arguments from the networks and from journalists and from broadcasters. But I think that's all sort of months down the road at this point. I think right now is the sort of very narrow political battle over whether or not they're going to go ahead and do this and whether or not they're going to go ahead and do this in a budget bill.
That's itself controversial. Yeah, it's obviously not a budget matter.
If the change itself is fairly cynical, sticking it in a budget bill sort of, you know, doubles the cynicism of it.
Paul, you wrote interestingly on our website this week about how there's kind of a tension here in the mind of a journalist, right? On the other hand, we like the idea of everything being out there, and the notion of stopping people from using stuff seems somehow wrong. On the other hand, there's something sneaky and underhanded about this. Where do you come down on it? And beyond the legal issues, do you think it's right or wrong that these little clips should be used in attack ads?
I got more upset about what the government is doing after the government tried to defend it. I do think that journalists of all people should be relaxed about a conversation that's built on words and images. All my career, I have written words that could easily be used by anyone, either in their original form or a little bit distorted to make a political point. Mm. You know, I have no strong ownership of the words that I write. And surely television footage should be the same. But what the government says is, when a news organization objects to its footage being used, it is censoring the news.
That's not censorship.
That's a really strong word. And it's and the last person who should be deciding what a news organization does with its work is a member of a sitting incumbent government. That opens itself up to the kind of abuses that I don't want to contemplate as a Canadian. And so if Stephen Harper, or even a future Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, or a future Prime Minister fill in blank, says...
Thomas Mulcair.
Yeah. Says, you, Maclean's magazine, are gathering information and then putting the kind of spin on it that I am regally displeased with. And therefore, I am going to cut it up and turn it into a Frankenstein parody of what it used to be. And therefore, Canadians will be better served. Mm. That is something we should not be in the business of letting our governments do.
Yeah, they lose the argument when they start arguing that it's censorship, because it's just so obviously not a matter of censorship. The only way I think the word censorship makes sense is if they can convince their supporters and their base that this is censorship, that this is the networks are trying to protect Justin Trudeau, and so what we need to do is we need to not let them protect Justin Trudeau, and we need to show Canadians the truth about Justin Trudeau. But even then, I mean, that's a narrow argument. And again, on the larger public argument, once you invoke censorship, you've gone way, way off track.
Let me bridge us over to Justin Trudeau for a minute. let's face it, at the root of this debate over how attack ads are made and what material goes into them is the thought that the conservatives think there's a rich vein of embarrassing Justin Trudeau moments to mine. This week was an interesting week. Some people think Justin Trudeau had a bad week. Paul, do you think he had a bad week?
I think he had a bad week, but I don't think that ends his career necessarily, right?
So what was bad about
it? Why do we have a bad week? Well, because he is almost alone among Western party leaders in believing that this military intervention in Iraq and perhaps Syria and perhaps Turkey to deal with the Islamic State is somehow uncouth and beneath the dignity of a country like Canada. The Brits are in favor. The Americans, the U.S. president, who is certainly more popular in Canada than in the U.S., dreamed up this this coalition. The socialist government of France is sending fighters. You name it, Denmark, you know, and so Justin Trudeau and Tom Mulcair think it's a bad idea. Now, you expected Tom Mulcair to think it was a bad idea. The question was, what would Trudeau do? Trudeau's come up with his very pacifist stance. Why do I not think it's necessarily a deal breaker for in terms of his electoral chances? Because I remember that John Chrétien was against the Gulf War in 1991 and, in fact, said some loopy things about the Gulf War in 91. He said that we should send 2,000 soldiers, but as soon as it looks like they might fight, we should send them back, and so on. And he went on to win a very comfortable majority government.
Interesting conversation, you guys. We'll see if any of this ends up in attack ads later. Thank you, Paul Wells and Aaron Wary, for chatting with us. And that's it for the McLean's panel this week.
Still to come on McLean's on the Hill, we speak with Edmonton Mayor Don Iveson about the infrastructure needs of municipalities. We talk about income inequality in education, and we bring you Question Period in Review. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
It's no secret that Canadian cities have been dealing with an infrastructure deficit, especially with Canada's fastest growing municipalities. It's a problem that's been around for years. While at the Canada 2020 conference, McLean's political editor Paul Wells sat down to chat about infrastructure with Edmonton Mayor Don Iveson.
You had some interesting stories to tell, as almost any big city mayor would, about the challenges that you have dealing with infrastructure. What are some of those challenges?
Well, first of all, Alberta's Canada's fastest growing province. Edmonton is Alberta's fastest growing city, and therefore also the Canada's fastest or the nation's fastest growing city. And so we've got growth pressures. 3.5% growth in population. And that's about the most that an industrialized economy can manage before things just go sideways. So we're having trouble building schools, hospitals to keep up. We can manage roads and drainage and the basics, but it's tough. There are constraints. And at the same time as the city is growing, it needs to adapt. And so we've got this urban shift that we're doing. You know, as many sprawling North American cities struggle to now build up to revitalize older areas, we're working to do that. Key feature of that is transit, which, you know, we've been investing in. We were actually the first North American city to build light rail back in the late 60s. We started the work and built it, opened it in the 70s for Commonwealth Games in 1978, and we've added to it incrementally since then. And we've got provincial and federal investment lined up to build another 13 kilometers of it the next few years. But out beyond that, I have no certainty. And I've got another, many billions of dollars worth of light rail that I need to connect people to jobs and to school and to entertainment and to keep activity vibrant in our downtown, to decongest our roads, to clean our air, to help people deal with the rising cost of housing by lowering their cost of transportation. Like every other mayor of a major Canadian city right now, I've got a multi-billion dollar transit plan. We hear a lot about Toronto's, which is essential. Having lived there and having traveled there, it's essential. But it's equally essential in Ottawa to get phase two of the light rail, a line of sight to that. Equally important in Edmonton and Calgary, equally important for the Broadway subway line and for Gregor in Vancouver. And so we get together as big city mayors and we sort of compare our lists, and the needs vastly outstrip the resources that are available, not just federally, but also provincially and certainly within our own municipalities with the limited resources we have, growth pressures we have, aging infrastructure we've inherited, and so on and so forth. So the scale is broad, but But there's a coalition of people working on it, and more discussion about the upsides of making these investments in transformative infrastructure that'll keep Canada competitive.
Okay. Now, Edmonton sits, you know, it's the gateway to the oil sands in a sense, which is the most economically dynamic, politically sensitive part of the Canadian political economy right now, identified not just by the Conservatives but by the Liberals as a driver of future growth. Mm-hmm. Given all of that, are you surprised, as I sometimes am, that Edmonton-Fort Mac, the Edmonton-Calgary connection, doesn't seem to have the political attention that it might seem to justify?
Well, I think from the central to eastern Canadian perspective, it's still not necessarily fully understood just how much of the economic growth is being driven in Alberta and in northern Alberta in particular. Last year, 40% of the jobs in this country, net new jobs, were created in my city region. Now, the question is, what do we want to do with the prosperity that we've generated from this today? I think we should be building infrastructure, and we should be investing in human capital so that we can be competitive into the future. And we should be supporting research and development that further improves the cost competitiveness and environmental performance of the oil sands.
That's McLean's political editor Paul Wells speaking with Edmonton Mayor Don Iveson.
Also at the conference, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes spoke about income inequality in education with Miles Korak, an economics professor at the University of Ottawa's School of Public and International Affairs.
This debate has different dimensions. One of them in Canada is regional. I know that at McLean's, when we've had some pretty lively debate about income issues and how's the median income group in Canada done, we've tended to use national data. That's what we fall back on debating. But is that wrong? Should we be thinking about it more on a province-by-province or region-by-region basis when we talk about this issue?
It's not wrong. All of these things depend upon your purpose.
Right.
The national data tell us a story. Mm. That's important to talk globally about Canadians. But it's always important to look at underlying causes. And in Canada, the regional dimension is one of those causes.
Right.
So I think if you want to fill out your story, it's really important to know that certain communities in Saskatchewan, many communities in Alberta, are just booming tremendously. Mm. Also Newfoundland and Labrador. So these are economies in which the typical family, in terms of income, is doing much better than it did two or three decades ago.
Right.
But in contrast, in Ontario and in Quebec, incomes really haven't improved all that much, and in fact probably a little bit of a downward trend after 10, 20, 30 years of economic growth and increased productivity, no gains. So that's really important to highlight, I think.
When people talk about the institutional underpinnings of reasonable social mobility, they often, these days, and including today at the panel you were in, the conversation swings to early childhood education and what happens in the first years. What's your perspective on that? First, is that a place that we should be focusing attention? And second, what kind of attention? What kinds of policies would make sense?
The early years are certainly important. I mean, there's no single magic bullet to this, but if you don't get a good start in life, if children aren't raised in a stable and loving environment with sufficient material and other resources, the playing field starts to get tilted. And so making sure that we're supporting families in that context is probably the most important thing we can do. Mm-hmm. Now, how we actually design our policies to do that, well, the devil's always in the details in these cases. And we had a discussion, for example, about whether early child support should be targeted on lower-income people. Or
Income-tested in some way.
That's right. Or whether it should be universal. Mm. And there are trade-offs in doing that. What's really important is to keep the quality high. So, for example, the move to putting four-year-olds into the JK system in Ontario is probably, I think, in the long run, a good decision because we can be assured of high quality of the investment across the board. But in other dimensions, we might want to target things a little bit more because you need sufficient resources to pay for what is probably a very expensive investment.
Universality is expensive.
It is. On the other hand, there's a downside to not being universal because people won't feel like they're part of the community, and some people might feel stigmatized. And if the design promotes that, then it's probably not politically sustainable and probably has more costs than benefits. So it really depends. I mean, you're talking to an economist, John, so in some sense it does depend how you design it.
That's Miles Korak, an economics professor at the University of Ottawa's School of Public and International Affairs, discussing income inequality in education. For more of McLean's coverage of the Canada 2020 conference, head to mcleans.ca.
And now it's time for our question period in review. We're joined by the host of QP Live on McLean's.ca, Nick Taylor-Vasey, who takes a look back at all the action this week on the floor of the House of Commons.
So Canada is off to war. The Air Force's primary mission in Iraq will come in the form of airstrikes that target Islamic State fighters wherever the coalition of Western warplanes can find them. The House of Commons approved Canada's mission early on this week, but the NDP, which voted against combat, wouldn't let the government march blindly into war. Party leader Tom Mulcair opened Tuesday's question period having read a report about Islamic State recruitment, which was buoyed in the wake of recent airstrikes.
Doesn't the Prime Minister realize that these current tactics, the same ones he wants to follow, will only create more recruits for ISIS and can, in fact, be disastrously counterproductive?
The Prime Minister didn't answer the question, but he did repeat the military's major objective in Iraq.
In the absence of any response, ISIL was growing like cancer over the summer, over an entire region. This constitutes a threat, not just to the region, to the global community entirely, and also to Canada. Mr. Speaker, that's why it's essential that we work with our allies to undertake steps to make sure we limit the military capacities of this organization.
President Barack Obama hopes to degrade and ultimately destroy Islamic State. Harper's words manage expectations somewhat. Paul Dewar, the NDP's foreign affairs critic, wondered aloud on Wednesday about the Air Force's ability to deploy its people in planes in a timely manner.
We've now learned that it will take nearly a month for Canadian forces to get there, and there's no confirmed place to stage our planes. We now saw the same thing when we heard the government deploy 69 military advisors, but only 26 were needed. Mr. Speaker, why did the Conservatives use urgency as an excuse to cut short the debate on Iraq when they're not ready to go?
Defense Minister Rob Nicholson stood and, wouldn't you know it, told the House some real news about the mission in Iraq.
I can confirm for this House that just this morning we received approval from Kuwait to launch our planes from there, Mr. Speaker, and I want to thank the Canadians for their cooperation.
Dewar had more questions on Friday. He asked simply what Canada hopes to accomplish in Iraq and what success would look like.
What are the objective standards of success for this combat mission?
This time, Dewar got Immigration Minister Chris Alexander.
We and this Prime Minister have learned a lesson from Afghanistan that is very important. It requires military effort to prevent a terrorist safe haven from emerging across the length and breadth of an entire country. That's why we're supporting this military mission. It's 6 months in length. It's a very limited number of aircraft. It's to degrade the capacity of the Islamic State to deliver terrorism against the people of Iraq and around the world, Mr. Speaker. Those objectives are very precise.
Alexander wants to degrade Islamic State, fair enough. But no one on the government side has explained yet what they reasonably expect to accomplish to that end. As the Air Force prepares to deploy, the House heads into its Thanksgiving break. Just don't expect anyone on the opposition benches to forget all the questions still in the air about Canada's next showdown with overseas terrorists.
Once again, with Question Period in Review, that's Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.